I want to talk about language, relationship between language and rhetoric, and the conveyance of meaning, and how we think about meaning. Because I think the ways that we think about meaning, right? If you ask somebody, what are words? How is meaning conveyed? How does communication work? The answer would be very different than what they actually do and how they operate with language. I've argued that, in some sense, there's no such thing as language. There's a great line in Merleau-Ponty, Maurice Merleau-Ponty, and he says, you know, language only exists when it fails, right? You only know that there's this thing, language, when something really went awry and you're kind of thrown off, right? It's a moment of alienation. But otherwise, you know, Merleau-Ponty says, you know, we have this thing, language, as we have limbs. You know, one of my favorite lines he has is, you know, I reach for a word as I reach for an itch. Which is to say, for Merleau-Ponty, language is, it's not this tool set. It's not like there's these sets of words that, you know, are like arrows that come with their, you know, their feathers of meaning, and I can shoot them, you know, hit my target, and you know, voila! I conveyed my love. I conveyed the complex notion of repetition. I told them it was raining. You know, it's Merleau-Ponty, phenomenology of language. And I consider rhetoric the phenomenology of language. Begin from a different place altogether. It's not this set of tools that are outside of me that I then reach for in order to convey something, right? That would assume that I know what I think, and that thinking is free of language. And then I think, okay, that person's over there, and I want that person to know what I'm saying. And so I choose my words and I toss them over there, and then that person will understand, hopefully, what I'm saying. That model of communication, that model of what I'll call the communicative event, how we even imagine what it is to communicate, what we want from communication, how communication could, should, might function, I think is begins from a fundamentally sort of silly, erroneous, an idealist place. Right? It has an architecture, a distribution of the relationship between life, human life, life in general, and language that just doesn't seem right to me. I think we generally imagine that language comes after the fact. Right? First there's life, some kind of pure life, some sort of clean life. There's just pure living. And then we adopt language. But I begin from something, a different place altogether, right? Because there's no life that's not always already expressed, right? I don't come to expression. I can't help but express myself. Life can't help but express itself. Life is always already expressing. Does that make sense? I just sort of decide to start expressing myself. The fact is, you know, here I am. I got this tone of voice. I'm already prefigured as a gender. I'm prefigured as my class, by all these various ways, by my culture. I have a tone of voice. I have a timbre. I have a rhythm. Those things are not, I don't come to those things. I can't separate myself from those things. There's no moment of me that's not already expressing itself, right? I mean, when I was just, you know, a fetus, you know, I was already expressing myself. I already had, I emanated percepts. I emanated something to be perceived, you know, at that point, mostly by my mother, but conceptually by, you know, my older brother and sister and family, that there was something coming, right? That I was something. I was already being expressed, right? And expression is interesting that way, right? That it's not something I do as much as it's something I participate in. Right? I come to an entire sort of expressive field, a field in which there are a lot of rules already, all sorts of expectations, all sorts of prefigurings of what counts as something to say, what counts as a reaction, what counts as, you know, a mode of what it means to interact. The expressive field, for lack of a better word, is infinitely rich, right? And it comes from a breadth and diversity of places, right? That is defined as much historically and culturally and circumstantially, right? But what I'm trying to do is create this is a different image of how it is we participate in language and how it is we even come to convey meaning. Because I want to give a different image of that so that we begin thinking about interpretation, begin thinking about sense-making and how we interact with other people in a different way. So I want you to picture this infinitely rich field that's in which communication and expression is always already happening. The rock is the rock. It already has meaning. The building, the car, all these things are drenched in a meaning that precedes them, that they participate in. Right? Expression, communication happens in what we might call the middle voice. Right? In language and in English, we talk about the active voice. We talk about the passive voice. Right? So the active voice is, you know, I go to the store. I'm the active subject of the sentence. Go is the verb. I'm the doer in that sentence. In the passive voice, you know, you say with the alternative there would be the passive side of running would be. Smoking is prohibited. Right? I can say, you come to my house. I can say you can't smoke. I disallow smoking here. I am, as an active sentence, I am the one doing the disallowing. When I say smoking is prohibited, well, what's the subject of the sentence? There is no subject of the sentence, right? That's what's called the passive voice, you know, and it's a common sort of go-to for people who aren't quite sure in their writing or their communication, but really who's doing what to whom. You know, and you don't know quite what to do. You rely on the passive voice. The government loves the passive voice because it doesn't want to say, the armed police state prohibits smoking. Yeah. They move to the passive voice as if it's this collective decision, right? It's a rhetorical move to make it passive. English doesn't really have other voices, but you know, there is this ideal. That I understand that in classical Greek they have, I can't vouch for that, called the middle voice, in which one is neither active nor passive. You know, I know that in Romance languages and in French, you're often acting upon yourself, right? You say, when you say, what's your name? You say, je m'appelle. I call myself, right? Je m'assise, I sit myself down. So you become both the subject and the object of the sentence. Which begins to approach a middle voice in which you're neither subject nor object. You're both subject and object. You're in this other space. And I want to suggest, what I want you to imagine is that communication happens in this middle voice. Right? You're neither the master of your communication, right? Nor simply the plaything, right? You're neither, you know, what do I mean by that? Well, you want to say something, right? You want to say something to somebody. There's no way that you can just take up meaning and own it all into yourself and just hand it over to that person. Right? First of all, you're coming to a situation that you're always reacting to. You're reading the mood, you're reading the tone, you're following grammatical rules that you didn't make up. I mean, language pre-exists you, predates you, prefigures your very mode of communication. You know, how could it be otherwise? You don't choose your words. You know, words already exist. Right? I don't make up words. I mean, sometimes I make up words, but very, very rarely. You know, for the most part, we all participate with these words, right? These words that nobody owns, that are just in play, sort of like the air, right? I breathe in air that's been breathed by lots of other people. I take in words that have been used by lots of other people that are will never have been mine, right? There might be certain words we come to kind of possess in the colloquial sense of just like, you know, a word you associate with someone. Someone just really likes to say certain things, you know. And a really silly example would be my friend Brian, who likes to, you know, when we're talking, I'll say something and his mode of agreement would be totally, totally. I totally adopted that from him. Right? And I know a lot of people might use that, but I had never used that expression before. So I, in a way, in my mind, he owns that and I always give him credit. But of course he doesn't own that. Totally, he didn't make up totally. We come to words. We come to grammar. We come to the situation, the context, the mood, all the things that are happening. I didn't dictate those terms. I have to read them. I come to them as much beholden to them as they are to me. You know, I'm more beholden. And then within this milieu, right, whether it's my child or a friend or a client or my sweetie pie, they all already have their stuff going on. They're already in a situation. Our very relationship to each other is already figured. Right? There's no pure communication. There's no pure word arrow I can pick up just to, you know, try to pierce them. Right? I want you to get rid of that whole model of communication, of trying to pierce, of trying to hit the target. That is just not how communication happens. That is just not how language works. And because we often think, we assume that's the way it should work, we often think we're failing. Or when we sit down to write or to talk, we're going after an ideal that is fallacious to begin with, that will never have been true, that is not, it just doesn't express the way of expression. So I'm trying to cast or paint a fundamentally sort of different picture of expression, of this expressive field in which I come in the middle voice. In the middle voice, at once reacting, reading what's happening in front of me, and then from there I get to make choices, right? Like the DJ reading the room. I get to put on, you know, The Cure, The Pixies, or I always use the same examples, Broken Social Scene. I get to put those on, but that doesn't necessarily just dictate the mood. The mood is bigger than that album, right? I can put it on, and things might or might not click, right? I mean, that's the DJ is not the master in terms of being some kind of Moses, some kind of creator of the laws. You know, the DJ is as much responsive as creative. Right? The DJ, like all art, exists in this sort of middle voice. And it's this middle place. I come to my son, and my son's already, I'm already his father. There's no way I cannot be his father. I don't begin from a neutral place. I come to a space that is saturated historically, culturally, semiotically with meaning, with relationships. And from there, I begin this process of communication. I begin this process of communication that will always already have happened. So when I enter this field, the saturated field, this field that I'm at once subject to and creator of, I'm not looking for a word to cross an abyss and pierce the heart of my interlocutor, right? That's not what's going on here. We're all enmeshed in these flows, this sort of common milieu, this sort of ooze, this what Merleau-Ponty might call the flesh of communication. It's infinitely rich, it's dense, there's lots of stuff between me and you when I say a word, when I make a sentence. And when I I take up this word, when I take up this sentence, it will never itself be free of expression, right? It's not like I can choose the word, the word expression, any particular word, and have it be free of expression. There is no example of a word that is not already made flesh. There is no word that's not already expressed, that's not already coming out of a particular position in a particular place by a particular person. The person writing the dictionary is deeply enmeshed in, yeah, that's a person who's enmeshed in dictionary culture and is writing that word down. There's no instance, there's no possibility of a word that is not expressed, that hasn't already been expressed, that hasn't always already been expressed. There's no pure meaning of that word. All there are the possibilities of that word, the history of that word, all the possible ways that word can be expressed. As an aside, it's one reason I love when people screw up a word and I pronounce it differently, you know, on a different accent, or they use it, you know, like a malaprop, they use the wrong word in the wrong way. I love that because it shows the possibility of a word, of what a new word can be. It's really through the so-called mistake that a word begins to find new modes of expression. But again, I come to this field, I come to this world, I come to some situation, my sweetie on the couch, my son in his room, a client in a meeting, me prattling on right now into a microphone, right? And it's already determined in many, many ways, but at the same time is open, right? It's not predetermined, it's not done. All kinds of things could happen, right? We don't know what I'm going to say next. I don't know what I'm going to say next. And I reach for these words, and these words, they're not these neutral things. It's not a neutral thing that I pick up, and my version of the word version and your version of the word version are not the same. I say version, you say version. They're two different versions, right? I say potato, you say potato. We have, these are different things. So if language is always already expressed, and I am not, I'm not just throwing a chunk of meaning, this ideal concept, above the body of language to you, but rather I am throwing the meaning with the body. We can't separate the meaning from the body. I can't separate the meaning of the word from the word. And the way the word is written and sounds coming out of my mouth. There is no such moment, right? I'm always already expressing myself, right? Which is to say, I am always performing. I'm always doing, right? I'm always performing the word. And this is what, you know, people call the performativity of language. Language is not just a conveyance of meaning, right? It's not just these arrows that seamlessly or naively carry the concept, this pure meaning, across the abyss that separates me from you. No, that will never have been the situation. It will always be this embodied, rich, fleshy experience, right? The meaning of the word and its wordiness, its body, its rhythm, its shape, those particular sounds, its whole history, its connotation, its denotation. We can't separate these things. The sort of formal meaning from the sort of sense of it can't be separated. How could they be? In a particular situation, we might parse and try to alienate a word sort of in a lab and talk about it, and that's not necessarily a bad thing. But that's not, you know, that is just one mode of expression, one mode of a communicative event. Generally speaking, you know, when I come to you with language and communication, it is rich with the human patina. It is rich with flesh. It is rich with saliva and sound and feeling and sensuality and you know, it will rub you or not the right or wrong way. That's That's what language is. It's always performed. It's always performing itself. And this performance of a word, I don't want you to think about performance in terms of like a stage in some kind of extreme situation outside the everyday. I want you to think about performance more like performing a task. It's simply that which is done. It's a doing. So I want you to think about the word performance, the performativity of language, in terms of the doing of language. It's bodiness, it's bodiliness, it's fleshiness. Language is always performed, and this performance, this speaking, this utterance, whether written or spoken, is always a little conceptual. It's referential. It has a meaning, but it also has a body. And while the two are not one and the same, they are so intimately intertwined, right? They are marbled, right? I love this figure of marbling, because the black and the white don't mix to become gray, right? But you also can't separate the white from the black. You can see them. You see that they're different. Yet the thing that makes it marble is precisely that they're so intimately intertwined without becoming one. They don't unify. It's an incredible thing about marble, right? The colors maintain their distinction. At times they might become a gray. There'll be different shades of gray, different brown, different blacks become a kind of brown or white. But they maintain differentiation while nevertheless holding an impossibly intimate entwining, right? They co-share their identities, right? Without one or the other, it's no longer marble. Such is marble, is this entwining. And so it is with communication, with words. And the body of a word, the fact that the word word is W-O-R-D, the fact that it word, the fact that it's, you know, I come from wherever I come from and I say the word word a certain way, is part of its body. And that creates all kinds of interpretive possibilities. It introduces this sort of radical multiplicity. Because the word is not one thing that's set down and pinned in a dictionary like a butterfly pinned to a whatever the fuck they're pinned to, right? Pinned to a piece of paper. The word is every possible utterance of that word. Right? It is all these expressions. There's no one master use of the word. All there are all these different uses of the word. All there are all the different performances of our words. Right? There's no master term that sits above them. Instead, we get this incredible proliferation, this differential equation that approaches the infinite of all the possible modes of how a word can be said. And that is that word. Right? A word is a becoming. A word is a differential equation. It is always going towards a limit. It has a certain limit in terms of concept and meaning and spelling. But even that begins to break down a little bit, right? With textese now, they drop out vowels and, meaning changes. But it still changes within a limit. But that limit is infinite. So a word is a differential equation, right? And with an infinite limit that it's always approaching and never reaching. There's no final moment you get there and you say, here's the word. Well, you get these iterations. And this is the performativity. This is what's called the performativity of meaning. Meaning is something that is performed. It's not sent. It's not simply conveyed from point A to point B. It moves through an infinitely rich field. I am a rich field myself. The words, the communication comes out of me. I utter it this or that way according to my mood, my timbre, my tone, across a field that is itself saturated with mood and texture and tone, and then falls on ears or not of other, other people's multiplicities, your multiplicity, your team, and certain things will come in and you'll hear things and not hear other things, and that won't be a failure of communication. That will itself be communication. I want to suggest then You know, and this will be a move that might surprise some people, but I want to suggest that communication, what I call rhetoric, is the word made flesh. Will mean something to those of you, you know, well-heeled in your gospels, and not to others, right? But in what we call the New Testament, oh, the Gospels. Called the New Testament is to suggest that there's a New Testament and Old Testament, which is to suggest Jesus was real. So only a Christian calls it New Testament, right? So I'll call it the Gospels versus the Torah. So in the Gospels, in John, you know, the very beginning of John, it says, you know, in the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God, and the Word was God. Okay? I'm going to repeat that because it's, you know, in the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God, and the Word was God. And I take that to mean, you know, that the word, language was there was a pure meaning that wasn't yet embodied. There was this pure meaning that was one-to-one with God, one-to-one with communication, one-to-one with communicative efficacy that had nothing to do with all this fleshiness, all this tone and patina of language and saliva and salaciousness that I seem to be suggesting is imminent to communication and expression. But then down in John 1:14, he says, "And the Word was made flesh and dwelt among us, and we beheld his glory, the glory as of the only begotten of the Father, full of grace and truth." But it's the Word made flesh. That the interesting thing to me always about the Gospels, and I've read them repeatedly thanks to, you know, motels, and my propensity to read on the toilet, and the fact that the Gospels are just quite readable, you know, unlike the Torah, which is, you know, reading the Torah is like, you know, Moby Dick. Reading the Gospels is like watching Rashomon. You know, it's just four versions of the same story. It's very discreet. But you get this movement from the abstraction of the word, really, which is Judaism, monotheism, is God. God is outside this world and kept pure. And Jesus, what's incredible about Jesus is that he's the Word made flesh. Right? He is the Word always expressed historically and specifically in this body, in this time, in this place. So you get the eternity of meaning, all of a sudden embodied in a particular body, right? And that introduces the great complexity, the great beautiful multiplicity of the Word made flesh of Jesus. You know, I'm not proselytizing here. I'm not proselytizing. I see John 1 through 1:14 as an argument about rhetoric and about communication. And I see communication and expression as the Word made flesh, as the Word removed from its abstraction, its radical pure abstraction, and introduced into the messy multiplicity and radical temporality or historicity of the flesh, which is to say, everything I'm kind of saying about performativity, but the Word made flesh, is that it's temporal. Right? Rather than a meaning being set in place, standing outside of time, and I exist as this temporal creature, you exist as this temporal creature, but I grab this thing that's eternal, such as the meaning of the word love, and I send it to you. But I want to suggest is that eternity never exists outside of the temporal. That the temporal and the eternal are not opposed. And that's really, for me, what rhetoric and language introduce. And then later, after rhetoric, you get Christianity, and you get Jesus Christ, who complicates this relationship as well, right? Who begins to bring together in various modes of interpretation the relationship between the eternal and the temporal. And that's what Jesus is. That's what Christianity offers the world. It's very different than you know, Islam and Judaism, which is that you get that monotheistic, all-knowing God, all of a sudden radically temporal, radically specific, radically embodied, Right? Is he this body, this person? And to me, that's what rhetoric is. Rhetoric is the movement from language, Judaism, to rhetoric, which is Christianity and Jesus, right? It's the word made flesh. And once you introduce the flesh into language, you introduce historicity, you introduce meaning, a movement into meaning, you introduce performance, action, the doing of something as a multiplicity within a field of multiplicities, you end up with very different terms of what communication entails and what we want from communication. So, you know, this will be an ongoing conversation, but I'll leave you with this, that rhetoric is the word made flesh. Rhetoric is the word made flesh.